couple of the standard preliminaries. First, I'd like to circulate this little 2003-2004 participation log. If you were here last time and signed it, don't feel obliged. In fact, please don't sign it again if you haven't been here before. We're trying to kind of keep track year by year of whose faces show up, so feel free to add your signature and other information if you wish to it. And I'll trust that I'll get that back at the end. Secondly, I've got Bob Krogan generously brought over some additional copies of the paper. If there's anyone here who doesn't have a copy, I would like one. Anyone else? Okay. So that's pretty good counting, Bob. Third in the line of ensuring that everybody gets his or her full quota of paper, we've got the schedule for the 3 second term LRI seminars. So I'll circulate that. Take a copy, give one to your significant other, and look forward to the good stuff that is coming in term two. So with all that background then, I would flag for people the topic of our presentation today. It's harmonious continuation of the actual order of this universe and God's self-communication. Dr. Daniel Mansour is the presenter, and Professor Robert Dorn is the commentator. Bob and Danny said that going to have a slight variation on our usual order, where the presenter talks for maybe up to 30 minutes, and the respondent gives a 10-minute commentary. If I've got this correctly, Danny's going to just say a few things to kind of get our curiosity excited and our vital juices flowing, and then Bob will develop the point at say a longer chunk of stuff, and then Danny will finish up the response. After that's done, then we'll have our full-fledged, enthusiastic discussion. So over to Danny.
Thanks. A few people have expressed a certain perplexity regarding the title. So I thought in the presentation to spend some little time trying to say something about some of the terms in the title. And after Bob's response to the paper, I want to say something very quickly on one inadequate formulation in the paper and on a further issue. The expression harmonious continuation is taken from chapter 20 of Insight, the chapter entitled Special Transcendent Knowledge. In the previous chapter, Lonergan had argued for the existence of God. In chapter 20, he has to face the objection that stems from the fact of evil. To reconcile the fact of evil with a God who is good, and indeed goodness itself, the fact has to be not just a fact, but also a problem admitting of a solution. Chapter 20 attempts to outline the heuristic structure of the solution, that is, what can we know of the solution prior to its identification? So we have the discussion that characterizes the solution heuristically and culminates in the infamous, in the 31st place. Lonergan introduces the expression harmonious continuation in his third point. God's solution to the human problem of evil, already said to be one and universally accessible and permanent, is now said to be a harmonious continuation of the actual order of this universe. And the reason, unrestricted understanding does not have afterthoughts that implements standby plans when, to its surprise, things start to go wrong. With these four assertions, we are already, of course, in deep waters. And our understanding can do little more than flounder and splash about in the depths of what we don't really understand, at least not in any detail. But if floundering is the best we can do, it seems that here I have been given the task of floundering before you for a bit. If you want some indication of what is meant by world order, have a look at the list of properties of world process in chapter 4 of Insight. Useful too is the brief discussion of the unity of the proportionate universe in chapter 16. Its actual unity, Lonergan tells us, is an immanent intelligible order which we found reason to identify with a generalized emergent probability. The meaning of emergent probability is explained in a series of assertions in chapter 4, which culminates in what amounts to a definition. Emergent probability is a successive realization in accord with successive schedules of probability of a conditioned series of schemes of recurrence. World process is to be grasped, Lonergan will later say, by following the appropriate classical or statistical or genetic or dialectical methods. I note in passing that here are the seeds for a cure for our post-Copernican cosmic homelessness. And it is one of Lonergan's great contributions that has yet to be appreciated and implemented and become standard fare in the Christian psyche and in Christian thought and beyond. The solution to the human problem of evil is said to be permanent. This can only be so if the solution is integral with the intelligible unity of the actual order of this universe. The solution is accessible to all who need it. And since the aggregate of human beings, past, present, and future, need it in one way or another, it is accessible to everyone, if not in its full realization, at least in the form of an emergent trend. Do we understand how? I would be inclined to say not really, at least not in any concrete detail. We may extrapolate back from the identification of the solution and say that its accessibility involves the mission of the Son and Spirit, and that somehow the missions encompass the aggregate. But if we turn our thoughts, say, just to the uncounted ages between the dawn of humanity and the beginning of recorded history, we realize how little concretely we can say on this. If we allow that God's solution is universally accessible and permanent, what does it mean to say it is in harmonious continuation with the actual order of this universe? There is continuation because the solution is transcendent in the sense that it introduces something new, something beyond human nature considered in itself, some entitatively disproportionate higher integration into proportionate being that is radically beyond the inherent capacities of proportionate being considered in itself. Harmonious contrasts with dissonant. If the imminent intelligible order of this universe is to be identified properly with a generalized emergent probability, God's solution to the human problem of evil would be a dissonant continuation if it disregarded, abrogated, or violated emergent probability. If world order were, so to speak, complete in itself or closed in upon itself, except for being subject to God's bidding, like the car without the trailer in Lonergan's image. The solution, then, would be extrinsic to world order, and it would be added to or imposed upon world order as a makeshift or tacked-on afterthought by an omnipotent God. The solution is harmonious then, because as Lonergan says, it is a higher integration that leaves intact the natures and laws of the underlying manifold. Thus he writes, since the order of the universe involves the successive emergence of higher integrations that systematize the non-systematic residues on lower levels, it follows that the relatively transcendent conjugate forms, charity, faith, hope, will constitute a new and higher integration of human activity, and that that higher integration will solve the problem by controlling elements that otherwise are non-systematic or irrational. Again, there is the following statement which is worth pondering for its implication. The solution is a harmonious continuation of the actual order of the universe, and since that order is an emergent probability, it follows that the emergence of the solution and its propagation will be in accord with its with the probabilities. As far as I can see, obediential potency, carefully understood along the lines Lonergan has presented, is the only way open for us to acknowledge a solution that is at once an entitatively disproportionate higher integration and yet not an extrinsic addition to the intelligible order of the universe. It is the only way for theology to avoid the two-story universe, which rightly or wrongly, Cajetan is blamed for introducing into theology. I once read that a modern cosmologist, whose name I have forgotten, reflecting on the fine-tuning of the universe, remarked that the universe knew we were coming. Unless we are inclined to some form of pantheism, we are likely to feel the need to parse this remark. The way I would be inclined to parse it is to say that God from eternity knows and creates a world order such that in the by and by of ordinal time, living creatures endowed with intellects of unrestricted potency would bubble forth. God knows from eternity then that in the ordinal time of the universe we are coming. But there is perhaps a more important statement to make. God from eternity also knows and creates a world order open to the coming of God. There are no divine afterthoughts. And that's all I have to say for the moment.
Okay, we decided to do things this way today because when I spoke with Danny a couple of days ago, I said that in preparing my response, I wrote a summary of the paper, and he said, well, why don't you give the summary then? And I'll address the theological issue involved in the title. So Danny has just spoken to theological issues, and the paper itself is a set of methodological questions, by and large, behind these theological questions. But the notion of obediential potency comes into both the theological and the methodological, and that's one of the issues that I want to raise, and I think Danny's going to address that, the relationship between theology and method. So I'm going to divide my remarks into three sections. The first, and by far the longest, is the summary of my understanding of what he's writing in the paper that's written. Secondly, I'm going to offer a brief but extremely positive assessment of the position that he's put forth. And thirdly, call for collaboration and implementation. So the summary of the paper, and if this seems like it's going on, remember it's by far the longest part. My assessment is short but to the point, and the collaboration also. So the summary of the paper. The paper begins with the distinction between transcendental and categorical intending. The distinction that Lonergan presents in Method and Theology. Categorical intending regards what at first is a limited, partial, or elementary object, data, something for inquiring into being, these data. And it elevates these data to something actually understood, something actually real, something actually worthwhile, affecting oneself as originating value. Transcendental intending is the thrust of human consciousness towards the intelligible, the true and the real and the good. And it underpins and penetrates all categorical intending, which is always about this and that and the other thing. Next, then, the categories that Lonergan discusses in Method and Theology, general categories and special categories, those categories issue from the categorical intending that is underpinned and penetrated by transcendental intending. They are interlocking sets of terms and relations with limited denotations, and they cluster into groups or sets distinct from other sets. They might be just models, but theologians may come to view them as more than models. And if so, then their relations are no longer merely conceptual, and their terms are no longer merely objects of thought, but terms of real relations. Now, Danny's whole methodological question in this paper has to do with the relationship between what Lonergan calls general categories and what he calls special categories. But that has to do with the universe, general categories, and God's self-communication, special categories, the theological issues that Danny just addressed. So the general categories, then, are categories that theology shares with other disciplines. The base for deriving these general categories, or for appropriating them from other disciplines, or for transposing them from those other disciplines, the base of that is the normative pattern of recurrent and related operations that we employ in every cognitional enterprise, the conscious subject, attending, inquiring, reflecting, deliberating, the relations among these operations as they're given in consciousness, and specifically in one's own consciousness as an authentic or unauthentic person, as attentive or inattentive, intelligent or resistant to insight, reasonable or silly, responsible or irresponsible. So the base of the general categories is the theologian, as attentive, intelligent, reasonable, responsible, or the opposite. The special categories are the categories that are peculiar to theology. The base for deriving these categories, or for appropriating them from our tradition, or for transposing them from the tradition, is the conscious dynamic state of being in love in an unrestricted manner, religious experience, the actualization of the utmost in self-transcendence as conscious content. Or again, more specifically, the base is the authentic or unauthentic Christian, genuinely in love with God or failing in that love, with a consequent Christian or unchristian outlook and style of living. Being in love, as it is achieved, and to the extent that it is achieved in a particular theologian, is all that that theologian has as the effective base for deriving, appropriating, transposing, and developing the special theological categories. They all are dependent upon his or her religious experience. So the derivation of the categories takes place by way of expanding and enriching the respective bases. Danny distinguishes two kinds of expansion, one that is spontaneous and one that is reflective and thematic. The second kind of expansion and enrichment is mediated by the Christian and by the human and Christian subject effecting self-appropriation and employing this heightened consciousness as a basis for methodical control in doing theology and as some kind of relative a priori from which one can understand others, their social relations, their history, their religion, their ritual, their destiny. This derivation is not a logical derivation according to rules of inference, but a recapitulation in objectification. This is Danny's terminology, and I think he's going to clarify that for us later. A recapitulation in objectification of the base realities, so recapitulating them, filling them out, and the virtualities inherent in the base reality. Now, Lonergan's own account in Method regarding the derivation of general theological categories is basically simply a recapitulation of many points from insight and Method and Theology. Danny, very interestingly to me, gives his own spin on this because he suggests that we can take the general categories as Lonergan sets them up in Method and divide them into sets. And I think this is an extremely creative insight on Danny's part. Divide them into sets that might somehow correspond with Lonergan's explicit division of these special categories into sets You remember he has five sets of special categories. He doesn't give you sets of general categories. Danny is suggesting how you can take his list and put them into sets that would correspond, perhaps, to the sets of the special. He ends his account of this derivation of the general categories with the suggestion that what are most needed are the terms and relations for a general theory of development and a general theory of history. So that, as Lonergan says in a lot of his unpublished papers from the time of his breakthrough to method and theology, a systematic theology will be a theological theory of history. So that's the general category. The special category, the basic nest of terms and relations for the special theological categories, is our formulation of the conscious dynamic state of unrestricted being and love that results from God's gift of God's love as an expanded quality of our consciousness, as an experienced fulfillment of our thrust to self-transcendence. This formulation is not some simple thing, but demands a new theology of spiritual formation that would aid one in appropriating spiritual self-consciousness. That basic nest of terms and relations is common to many people and potentially to all, if God's gift is offered to all. And so we have a second set. That's the first set, appropriating religious experience. A second set of special theological categories expressing togetherness in community and service, witness, the history of salvation, and so on. A third set has to do with the source of our love, the Trinity, the processions of the Word and the Spirit, the missions of the Word and the Spirit. A fourth set is concerned with being in love and falling short of such an achievement. And a fifth set places all the preceding categories within the dynamic context of history. You'll have to excuse me, I'm getting over a cold and I get very thirsty reading a couple of paragraphs. Authenticity, this is quoting Danny's paper, authenticity provides the vectorial principle of social progress. Unauthenticity provides the vectorial principle of social decline. The divine missions ordered to each other, the mission of the Word and the mission of the Spirit, both as regards their constitution, their consequent term, and their prolongation through cooperative human agency, provide the third vectorial principle of redemption, in which there is a graced intussusception of human personalities and a leavening of human history to the undoing of the mischief of evil. Again, the significance of the theory of history is highlighted with an important quotation in the paper from Insight regarding the completion of the formal element in a treatise on the mystical body of Christ. And Danny concludes his section on the special categories with this statement. The theory of history would be a theory couched in general categories. Taken over in theology, they would become general theological categories and belong to the fifth set of such categories. Include consideration of the divine missions ordered to each other and their constitution and consequent term, include consideration of the historical causality exercised by Christ, consideration of the prolongation of the divine missions through cooperative human agency, and you have at least some of the core elements that constitute the vectorial principle of redemption in human history. Formulate these in nests of terms and relations, and you have special theological categories belonging to the fifth set of such categories, and a theology of history enhancing a general theory of history and making that general theory more concrete by the addition of the principle of redemption, again quoting Danny's paper. And to that I would add only an explicit reference, I think, particularly today, to the need for a consideration of the mission of the Holy Spirit in a far more explicit way than has been done, I think, point, the need for development in the area of pneumatology. So not only the historical causality exercised by Christ, but the historical causality exercised by the Holy Spirit. Now, we get to the main point of his paper, and that is the issue of the relation between general and special theological categories. And this is a very vexing question in theological method. The root issue at stake, I'm quoting Danny here, in the question of the proper relation between general and special categories is a recurring aporia underlying and penetrating much current theological thought, and especially evident in the twists and turns of theological thought fraternizing or succumbing to rationalism on the one hand, and theological thought fraternizing or succumbing to fideism on the other hand. Rationalism by collapsing everything into the general categories, fideism by neglecting the general categories and using only the special categories. So three questions, Danny has, three questions. The relation of the bases for general and special categories, how are they related to each other? How is the thrust of the human spirit related to the gift of God's love? Secondly, the relation of the spontaneous expansions and enrichments from these bases. And thirdly, the relation of the reflective expansions and enrichments from these bases. And his paper addresses only the first question, and it's largely determinative, however, of the answer to the second and the third questions. So here's the relation. How is the thrust of the human spirit to the intelligible, the true, and the real, and the good related to the gift of God's love? Danny says that will give you your answer to the question, how are the general categories related to the special categories? The relation is one of obediential potency, of that remote, essential, passive potency that is capable of being moved to receive a form by the omnipotent power of God alone. And that is what is meant by obediential potency. So to quote Danny, the base of general theological categories, the transcendental notions, as the unrestricted core of our capacity for self-transcendence, stands to the base of special theological categories, the state of being in love in an unrestricted manner in the relation of obediential potency. And then he goes on to show how that position is acceptable only within an intellectualist as opposed to a conceptualist framework, how a conceptualist framework gives you the two-story universe and so on. I won't go into the details of that, but he says, the base of the general theological categories, the transcendental notions as the unrestricted core of our capacity for self-transcendence, stands to the base of the special theological categories, the state of being in love in an unrestricted manner in the relation of obediential potency. Because the potency is a real orientation or order, being in love in an unrestricted manner is a real, intrinsic, proper, supernatural fulfillment of our natural capacity for self-transcendence. That's the harmonious kind. The fulfillment occurs in accord with the actual order of this universe that mirrors forth the glory of God. The missions of the Son and the Spirit are in harmonious continuation with the actual order of this universe, and were so from the beginning. In ways we hardly understand, this universe and everything in it were from the beginning oriented, ordered, and configured to the missions of the Word. Now, my evaluation, very briefly, I think Danny's suggestion is the key that I've been looking for years to the solution of a perplexing problem that is, and that's the problem of the relation between the two sets of categories. The problem of the relation of the general and the special theological categories is perhaps the single most to be worked out question, at least methodological question, that Lonergan left to us. It is a question that he did not answer in Method and Theology. And it's the contemporary rendition of the problem that split Catholic theology in the medieval period into the Aristotelians and the Augustinians. Today it plays itself out in various forms of correlationism, where the danger, and this is not true with everyone who employs a method of correlation, but there's always a lurking danger, at least as I read it, the danger is always one of reducing the special to the general. And so it plays itself out that way, and then it plays itself out in the positions that do not give sufficient grounding to the incorporation of the general categories. And in an article that I wrote in Theological Studies on Lonergan and Ron Balthasar, I think that problem threatens to divide theology again today, just as it did in the 13th century with the Aristotelian-Augustinian division. In my own work in Theology and the Dialectics of History, I tried to go to the heart of the problem that I think resides in the method of correlation, and at the same time to defend the use of general categories in theology, but I've never been completely satisfied with my presentation of the issue there, and I think I found the solution in this paper. I think Danny goes to the heart of the matter in a way that had not occurred to me before reading this paper. But there is one issue that is raised by the paper, and that is that it's a theological position that he's offering, and that theologically, so you're having theology determining method, and that is a question that I would ask Annie to address. So the only other thing that I'm going to say is that now let's get working at this. So now that we have this, what needs to be done now is to make an explicit attempt at grouping the general categories into sets, as Danny is suggesting, and then go to work on interrelating, particularly the general categories for history and the special categories for history and the missions of the Word and the Spirit. I would ask if anyone wishes to comment whether and to what extent my own attempts at theology and the dialectics of history contribute to that task, where I try to understand history in terms of the interrelations of the levels of value, where the lower or more basic levels, vital, social, cultural, personal, are conceived as being in a relation of passive potency to the higher levels, even though I don't use the language of passive potency, and where the level of personal value stands to religious value explicitly in the relation of obediential potency, and that is explicit in the book. But I'm just saying, I think Danny's paper gives us a key to getting to work on a major systematic project. So, my comment about the paper.
Okay. In the paper, I said that there were two kinds of expansion from each base. One kind of expansion arises spontaneously from each of the bases. Thus, in the case of general theological categories, the various patterns within which the operations occur, at least some of the manners in which operations proceed towards goals, at least some of the different realms and worlds of meaning, at least some of the differentiations of consciousness, the collaboration of believing, the structure of the human good, culture, development, history, and so forth, all are complications of the basic structure that arise spontaneously. Again, in the case of special theological categories, the togetherness in community and service, worship, witness, the history of salvation, the function of this history in promoting the kingdom of God, and so forth, are all spontaneous expansions of being in love in an unrestricted manner. I spoke of a second kind of expansion in methodical theology. This second kind of expansion is not spontaneous. It is a matter of applying the operations as intentional to the operations as conscious. It involves a reflective turn in which the conscious base and the first spontaneous kind of expansion become intentional objects and are objectified in general and special theological categories. And I said that in the case of both the base of general theological categories and its spontaneous expansion, and the base of special theological categories and its spontaneous expansion, the corresponding second kind of expansion in each instance recapitulates the base and the first kind of expansion. The trouble here is the word recapitulates. Even if what I have suggested about there being two kinds of expansion is correct, the word recapitulates is not sufficiently precise to capture what the second kind of expansion achieves, any more than the definition of a circle as a locus of points equidistant from a center is sufficiently precise to capture what a circle is. The second kind of expansion does not merely regurgitate the bases and the spontaneous expansions in objectification. For one thing, objectification can never capture the dense richness and lively adaptability of spontaneous operations or states and spontaneous complications and expansions from these operations or states. For another, if we agree that the primary function of systematics is expressed in the Augustinian and Anselmian precept, believe that you may understand, then the recapitulation involves understanding. Indeed, the goal should be explanatory understanding. The categories should exhibit the relations among the terms of each of the bases, between the bases and their respective expansions, among the terms pertaining to each of the sets of categories, and among the terms of the various categories. Here, the relations would fix the terms, and the terms would fix the relations, and understanding would fix both. What expression would serve to capture all these relationships? Would explanatory structural recapitulation serve? Explanatory because we are out to understand and not merely to describe. Recapitulation because beginning with a reflective turn, we are out to understand and express the real terms and real relations that belong to the bases and their respective spontaneous expansions. Structural because the goal is not the vain attempt to capture an objectification, everything in the bases and in their spontaneous expansions. Supposing I am on the right track, if anyone can come up with a better formulation, I would be happy to listen. The other issue. Is the claim about the basis for general and special theological categories standing in the relation of obediential potency an instance of a theological position influencing unduly and indeed purportedly settling what ought properly to be considered a methodological issue? Let me end by making some quick stabs at this. First, think of another case. As far as I know, the following claim has never been successfully challenged: that, as a matter of fact, the notion of creation out of nothing by God was a notion that philosophy did not attain by itself, independent of Judeo-Christian influences. Yet, if we allow that there are sound proofs for the existence of God, and that the proofs are philosophical in nature and not logically derived from revealed religion, one must also allow that doctrinal influences outside philosophy can contribute to the advancement of philosophy itself. This is really an instance of the principle that grace perfects nature, as Lonergan says, both in the sense that it adds a perfection beyond nature and in the sense that it confers on nature the effective freedom to attain its own perfection. Second, I am inclined to argue that the notion of obediential potency itself, at least as Lonergan himself has articulated it, is properly philosophical and not logically derived from revealed religion. That does not mean that it was in fact worked out independent of revealed religion and the need to hold together the various doctrinal demands of revealed religion. Third, it follows that at least in principle, the philosopher or methodologist could affirm obediential potency. But that affirmation would be just hypothetical. It would be the affirmation of a possibility. For actually to affirm an instance of obediential potency, actually to affirm that a natural potency has received a form beyond the proportion of its nature, would seem to go beyond what philosophy or methodology can say. Fourth, does all this amount to an instance of a theological position influencing and indeed purportedly settling what ought properly to be considered a methodological issue? I would grant that de facto there is an influence, but I would deny that it is an influence that results in confusing the task of the methodologist and the task of the systematic theologian. As grace can confer on nature the effective freedom to attain its own perfection, so we may suppose that theology at times can confer on theological methodology the effective freedom to attain its own perfection. So the theologian affirms that there are special theological categories. Already that puts the theologian beyond what the philosopher or methodologist as such can say. In particular instances, the affirmation can be a minimal affirmation of affirming categories merely as models. In other instances, the affirmation can be an affirmation of categories as real. Either way, if the theologian affirms that there are special theological categories, it seems that in considering the relation between general and special theological categories, he or she is constrained sooner or later, if not to accept explicitly either obediential potency or some version of a two-story universe, or at least to operate as if obediential potency or some version of a two-story universe is true. If the theologian in the face of theological requirements opts explicitly and wisely for obediential potency, he or she effectively settles the methodological issue of the proper fundamental relation between the bases of general and special theological categories. In such a case, the theologian in effect provides methodology with the effective freedom to attain its own perfection on this issue. The philosopher or methodologist as such, however, would overstep the mark if he or she affirmed obediential potency as instantiated. Theological methodology attains its proper perfection here if it affirms that if there are indeed special theological categories, then the fundamental relation between general theological categories and special theological categories would be one of obediential potency. This, I think, is entirely congruent with Lonergan's claim that the methodologist can affirm as models what the theologian can affirm as real.